I thank Professor Dirk Herarts for the presentation he gave on the role of historical diachronic linguistics and its importance for the analysis of metaphor. This afternoon at 3:30, I will give a talk on further advances in metaphor analysis and metaphor theory. So you'll start the day with new advances in metaphor analysis, and you'll end the day with new advances in metaphor analysis, and they will be supplementary. So some of you have asked me what my email address is, but in fact, if you go to my webpage, markturner.org, my email address is on the webpage. All you have to remember is Mark Turner. Search on Cognitive Science Network, or search on Google, and all of your questions will be answered. Up will come my website, up will come the Cognitive Science Network. My website has everything in it, answers to all of your questions. And so you can go there. Now, yesterday we talked about packing and unpacking and how concepts come from packing and unpacking. And so I want to say that the idea that words mean, or that they have meaning, or that expressions mean, or expressions have meaning, is a packed conception. It's completely false. Words do not mean. Words do not have meaning. Expressions do not mean or have meaning. These notions result from mental packing. Now, packed conceptions are very good things. We carry them around and we use them. And sometimes we believe them because we think they're true. And when we do that, we are living in the blend. We are living in the packed meaning. And we are not seeing outside it. But I want very much to try to get you to unpack these notions. Words do not mean. Words are prompts that a human being uses to try to get someone else to construct mental meanings. Words and expressions are tools that a human being uses to get someone to use mental operations that they already have to work on knowledge that they mostly already know, to put together a meaning. The words do not mean, the words do not carry meaning. There is an elaborate causality here. I have little tools. Right now, I'm trying to get you to make meaning, and I'm using these little tools. It goes from my use of tools to the work that you're doing, to the integration networks that you're putting together, and to the meaning that you understand. That's a long causal chain with a lot of agency. And you can compress that down and think that words have meaning the way things have color or a feature. That's very much at human scale. This wood is hard. It has a red color. And I can think, well, words have meanings. Now, similarly, agents do things. I'm an agent. You are an agent. The pilot can fly the plane. The painter can paint. That's agency. And I am an agent engaged in trying to get you to construct meanings. And we can compress down that whole network into the idea that the word itself is an agent, that the word is doing something, that words mean. But that's false. Words don't mean. Expressions don't mean. Meaning is not in words or in expressions. Meaning is in the mental operations that you conduct. The little prompts that I use to try to get you to understand something profoundly underspecify the meaning. There are many things that you can do with them. And almost everything about the meaning is not in any way carried in the words. Now, we saw this yesterday when I gave a list of expressions containing the word Father. If you had said, well, what is the meaning of Father that is in these expressions? That would be the wrong place to start. That is a mistake. When I use the word Father, you understand me as thinking that I would like you somehow to use the frame of kinship relation. You have that frame, and I would like you to do something with it as you're building an integration network. And in fact, in all those cases, I wanted you to do something quite different with it. I wanted you to do selective projection from the frame of often quite different things. And I wanted you to develop emergent meaning in the blend, very different emergent meaning. So Paul is the father of Sally. Joseph is the father of Jesus. The Pope is the father of all Catholics. The Pope is the father of the Catholic Church. Newton is the father of physics. And fear is the father of cruelty. It's just a mistake to ask, what does father mean in these expressions? It doesn't mean. It does not have a meaning. It does not carry a meaning. A word is a sound. It is a tool I use to prompt you dynamically to construct a meaning. Now, it may be that there are some meanings that you construct again and again and again and again and again and again, like father, for a particular kind of application of a frame to a domain. You do it again and again and again and again. Fine. You're doing it, and it's frequent. Don't mistake that for thinking that the word has a meaning. The word is a tool I use for you to construct a meaning, and I can use it in many different ways. In the way we think, Gilles Fauconnier and I take the word house, and we point out that the use of the word house as a tool may prompt people to construct certain kinds of integration networks. And some of them we construct again and again and again and again and again, and they become quite frequent and entrenched, and we're happy with them. That doesn't mean the word means. It's a tool to get you to construct that network, even if it's one that's very familiar to you. And we can use it in lots and lots and lots of different ways. Already, there's lots of data of lots of different uses of the tool, house, to get you to construct very different meanings. And we can come up with all sorts of novel meanings that don't even feel novel. Why? Because you are able to construct mental integration networks. And I can use these tools to prompt you to do that. You have meaning. I have meaning. The word does not know it has meaning. It does not even know it's a word. It is not an agent. That's a compression. It does not have a feature. That's a compression. It's a very useful compression to have in our culture. We can say, oh, in Chinese, what does this word mean? And someone can say, oh, it means beef, cow meat, or pig. And that's very useful. It's very useful. You're helping me get a meaning. But it's not a theory of language. Don't live in the blend. And we're going to be looking at some of that today. But I'll give you an analogy. This is a university that has historically specialized in aeronautics and astronautics. And I have seen wonderful warehouses of old airplanes and parts here. Now, suppose I have a toolbox, and there's a good graduate student in plane building here who has a toolbox. And we take our toolboxes to the museum, the warehouse, the junkyard of all these old planes. And we assemble a plane. And then we fly it. Yeah, we do. That's what we do with our tools. We act. Now, our toolboxes do not have an airplane. Our toolboxes do not fly airplanes. Our toolboxes do not know airplanes. No, our toolboxes are things that we use to make the airplane. And we can use it to make a car. We can use it to make a boat. We can use it to make things we want. But the toolbox is not magic. It is not an agent. It does not have a plane. It does not have a boat. It does not have the ability to fly. We do. We use these tools to make these things. Now, let's look at some of the mental packing that we observed yesterday. I pointed out, I see no clock. And I want to make certain I don't run over time. So I'll use another tool that will help me behave. This thing does not know the time. I know the time. This thing is a tool that helps me construct an understanding of the time. Okay? I pointed out that I can use the cause motion clause structure in English to get you to construct meanings. So, for example, if there's a diffuse set of stuff, I can suggest that you use the cause motion frame to blend with that compressed stuff so as to come up with a meaning. So we use the example, we blocked him from the door. Now, in the cause motion frame, you're causing an object to move. But block is another tool which we use to indicate a kind of force dynamic stoppage. That's not what block means. It doesn't have that meaning. It's something I say to you so you can construct this. The word doesn't understand force dynamics. It's just a sound. You use this to say, ah, I should somehow use the force dynamics of blockage, of stopping, in the cause motion frame, and you come up with a wonderful bit of emergent structure. Now, in the blend, the agent is causal and takes an action that affects the motion of him. It affects the motion not by causing the motion, but by stopping it. This is emergent structure. You take the cause motion frame, you take your force dynamic understanding of stopping. Block is a good tool for getting you to call this up. You put them together, you blend them, and in the blend, you now have a meaning. The blend is mental. The blend, you now have a meaning in which someone, we, perform actions that affect the motion of him, and the way we affect that motion is by stopping him on the path he was on going to the door. Now, that's emergent meaning. We're packing this situation into something like cause motion. Similarly, for I boiled the pan dry, there's a resultative motion, a resultative clause that I can use to say, I want you to use the frame of someone performing an action that causes a result for something. I want you to use that understanding. And I want you to use that understanding on words like I and boiled the pan dry, right? And you construct a scene. Now, the point I want to get to is just this one at the end. This is where we ended yesterday. Roman imperialism made Latin universal. Now, just think of the vast range of meaning that that goes over. Roman imperialism took centuries. It had lots and lots of agents, tens, hundreds of thousands of them, lots of actions, lots of events. This is not something that human beings are built to understand. It is beyond our scale. It is beyond the basic mammalian scale of the visual field of interaction with agents, but no problem, because the resultative action is something we do understand very well. And we can blend that basic resultative meaning that we know there's an action that causes a result for an object. We can blend that with all this diffuse structure to get a human scale blend that we can grasp. Roman imperialism is now an agent in the blend. And it's a causal agent. And it causes a result for the object. And the object is Latin. Latin is now an object in the blend. And the result it causes for the object is universal, which is a kind of funny feature when you think of it, right? If you paint the wall white, it's white. That's the result. There's a wall, and you do it, and it's white. Now, there's this thing called Latin, and you can and Roman imperialism can perform actions that cause Latin to have a result, and the result is that it's universal. What this means is that we can have very, very big ideas that run across time and space and agency and causality that is very far beyond what we're built to understand, because we can construct integration networks that have spaces in them that are what we are built to understand. And from that platform, we can grasp and hold on to and work in an integration network that otherwise we wouldn't understand. So that's why the topic of today's discussion is big ideas. I said in my opening lecture that there was a major question for cognitive science. That is, for all other species, the operation of the species, the understanding of the members of the species, seems to be very tightly limited in time and space. Right? Very tightly limited. And we can talk. I love animals, and I love experiments, and we can talk about the ways in which some animals, for some things, with certain kinds of support, seem to be able to extend just a little, beyond very local scale. Right? Now, we're not talking, of course, as I said, about how evolution can build things into the local scale that have long-range cause. So you don't need to be able to think about great-grandchildren in order to be attracted to a member of the opposite sex, because evolution has built desire right here into the local scale. And that will run a local scene that ends up having reproductive causation. So the question is not at all how you can operate, or evolutionarily how you can be designed so as to operate in the local scale and have long-range dependencies. The question is how you can conceive of them, right? How can human-scale thinking and feeling be involved in long-range causal patterns? And as I said, here we have to not live in the blend. We have to kind of unpack our sense of our own thoughts. It seems to us as if we have very stable thoughts, very stable ideas, very stable conceptions in the head, and they just stay with us, right? Memories, things like that. But in fact, biologically, your brain is always changing. Your brain is always activating different things. It comes and it goes, and nothing stays, right? All you have is the biology that you've got with you right now. Biology interacting with environments. That's all that's here. The only thing you have for these long-range ideas that are not here, that are not now, is the biology that you've got here and now. And as Sherrington said, the brain is an enchanted loom where millions of flashing shuttles weave a dissolving pattern, always a meaningful pattern, but never an abiding one, a shifting harmony of sub-patterns. And with what you've got in the present, right here, right now, you're able to think of ideas that are not restricted to the local understanding of agency, causes, and so on. You can think big ideas. How can you do that? Now, you might say, well, wait a minute. Doesn't memory bring the past into the present? Don't I have long-range ideas from the past that just are available to me? And the answer is, of course, no. Memory is right here, right now. Memory is your brain running right here, right now. It feels when we remember something as if a window opens from the past and the past comes into the present. But these different times never coincide. The past never comes into the present. That never happens. It just feels that way because that's the way we think. But don't live in the blend. What's happening is you are running right here, right now, things that present to you what feels like the past. Right? So, far from memory solving the problem of how we have big ideas, it's even a bigger problem. How can we have such memories? How can we feel at human scale about things that are beyond human scale? How can human scale thinking and feeling be involved in long-range causal patterns? And what's the role of language in that? Well, I want to introduce to you a wonderful machine. There is a man named Doctor Who on British television, and he has a thing called a TARDIS, time and relative dimension in space, and he gets in his TARDIS, and it takes him through time and different places in space. That's his TARDIS. It's a blue police box. And it flies through time. And it flies through space. So he can put together big ideas that run across the entire universe throughout its entire chronology. Yeah? Makes sense. It seems to us as if it's possible mentally to move around in time and space. And indeed, we do have a TARDIS, each of us. It is the ability to do advanced blending, advanced conceptual integration, to compress things so that we can have big ideas that run across time and space and go very, very far beyond the scale of thinking that any other member of any other species can even begin to conceive. We are extremely distinctive in this way. So here is Doctor Who's TARDIS, travel in space and time, time and relative dimension in space. And it seems to us as if we have a TARDIS. And here's a quote from Charles Fernyhough, in which he uses just the same metaphor that I want to use for escaping human scale. He says, "A self can feel such a singular fixture hugging one's here and now, like a 24-hour undergarment, but actually it's a string looping back and forwards in time to knit together our past and future moments." That's the problem. How can we do that? No other species does that. We're not built to do it. A self is a TARDIS, a time machine. It can swallow you up and spit you out somewhere else. So here's Doctor Who's TARDIS, and here's our TARDIS. We have a TARDIS. It's the human brain. I'm going to give you an example of such TARDIS work, such going beyond human scale to have big ideas. So easy for us. At the end of Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth, in which he's trying to get everyone concerned about climate change and global warming, he's going to say something that I will analyze here. But he starts off by saying that the Earth is a pale blue dot if viewed from 4 billion miles away. And in fact, he gives you a picture. This is from Carl Sagan. Carl Sagan made this famous of the pale blue dot in the Milky Way. You can see the Milky Way, and this is a close-up of the pale blue dot. That's the Earth. Okay, now he's going to do something very interesting. He says, notice that the Earth is just a single pixel in this image, and I say, that's the Earth. Now, it's even difficult to pick it out. The picture was taken from a distance of 4 billion miles, and Gore says, everything that has ever happened in all of human history has happened on that dot. All the triumphs and tragedies, all the wars and all the famines, all the major advances. That is what is at stake, our ability to live on planet Earth, to have a future as a civilization. Now, what's going on here? You cannot see the Earth from 4 billion miles away. You cannot travel 4 billion miles away. It's not even clear that it would be true that if you were at a distance of 4 billion miles, your vision would work the normal way. There are many things in physics that do not work the same way at great distances or at small time scales as we expect them to work in our normal human scale scene. But you know that if you back up something in your field of vision subtends a smaller angle, it gets smaller. And you can take the idea of the Earth and your knowledge of backing up and blend them. And in the blend, you've backed up 4 billion miles. This is completely impossible, of course. You can't do that, but you can imagine it. And now, in the blend, what's the Earth? It's this one little tiny thing. And you can see all of it in your visual field. Now think of your experience of visual field. What's in your visual field is at human scale. It can affect you. You can affect it. Think of a child falling down in front of you and crying. You feel a responsibility. You feel something immediate right there. Whereas a child who falls down 10,000 miles away, you don't even know. And if it does happen, you don't feel personally responsible. But now, in the blend, the Earth is something small in your visual field. And you're used to having some kind of authority, some kind of responsibility for the things that are in your environment. So suddenly, in the blend, you're now responsible for the Earth. And you might even be able to do something because it's small enough and it's at your scale. So he creates a spatial blend that compresses great, huge distances down into something you can see. And he also takes all of the events of the Earth and compresses them down to one thing, human civilization. In fact, he says all of everything, just right here on this little dot. This is a tremendous compression. Everything has become one thing, and it's your responsibility. And it's small enough for you to have power. And now he's going to do a time compression because he wants you to be concerned about the Earth. And in order to get you concerned about the Earth, he has to compress it in both time and space. Otherwise, the things that he cares about will be too far away for you to be concerned with. So he says, I'll put this one up bigger. He concludes the film with this blend. Future generations may well have occasion to ask themselves, what were our parents thinking? Why didn't they wake up when they had the chance? We have to hear that question from them now. Okay, so think about what he's talking about. Future generations, they're not here, right? He's talking about things that don't exist and that you're not going to see. They're not in your time scale at all. They're not even close. And there are billions of agents in those future generations all over the Earth, and they don't all speak English. And we're not even talking about them asking questions. We're talking maybe about what they think or how they feel or what they write. All of that gets compressed down into agents in the blend that are at human scale. Everybody knows about somebody asking you a question that you have to answer. They're right there in front of you. And everybody knows about children scolding their parents or being disappointed in their parents and asking them this question, why didn't you do this for me? Why did you do that to me? Parents have responsibility. All of that future generations, all of that stuff now gets compressed down into some children saying to their parents, why didn't you, what are you doing wrong? Give me an answer. Now notice this works even if you don't have children. In the blend you have children. You're not deluded. But now in the blend you have children. You can imagine having children. This is very much at human scale. And we have to hear that question from them now. So you take the scene of somebody asking a kind of challenging, maybe scolding question to somebody else. That's human scale. You take the frame of responsibility for children and you put it into a scene and compress all of that stuff that's at huge distant time right down here. The purpose of this is to pack into one scene, to get you to pack into one scene a conception that you will carry around with you and unpack as you operate in the world. So now maybe you want a car that burns a different kind of fuel, or maybe you want to plant some kinds of vegetables, or maybe you want to contribute to a certain kind of community effort or something. None of this is asking your children who are, or answering your children who are not here yet. But you have this responsibility in the blend, in the time blend and the space blend. And you unpack it to actions that you do take. So that's a rhetorical tool to get you to have a new conception at human scale, memorable, that you can hold on to and you can express with expressions that you have to get other people to hold on, to manufacture and hold on to, and to carry with you to change your actions in the world. Well, this is extremely common. Here is an advertisement, and it says, Joey, Katie, and Todd will be performing your bypass. And the patient, that's you, actually you seem to be in two spots. You're on the table, but the children are also looking at you. You're on the table, and these children look about 8 years old. And Katie is just about to cut into you with a knife. Okay. Now, this is a scene you will never see. You will never see eight-year-olds performing heart surgery. Okay? What has happened? Well, what it says is, before you know it, these kids will be doctors, nurses, and medical technicians, possibly yours. And if they're going to be any good at these things, they need to be educated now. Right? So the purpose of this is to get you to change your action now, to contribute money to schools. That's the way we do it in the United States. To contribute money to schools so that those schools will be able to educate those children. So long from now, in a time that you don't care about because you're not thinking about it, it's not at scale that you're built for, good things will happen. And in order to get that to happen, they have to make a time compression. And it's very easy, of course, once you see it, you will now go out of here and you will see these all over the place. What you do is take the identity connector. There are these children. They're currently 8 years old. Later on, they're going to be 35. There's a time connection. You compress the two elements into one. Now the 8-year-old and the 35-year-old doctor are the same one. You compress down the time. And now you've got like 10 minutes to teach Katie how to do surgery before she cuts into your heart. This is a scene that you can really respond to, right? And you can carry around with you. And it will change your behavior for long-range effect. Now the language works in just the same way. Before you know it, that's not true. That's a time compression. That's taking something that's 40 years from now and moving it down to right now. These kids will be blah, blah. If we want children who can handle tomorrow's good jobs, notice tomorrow doesn't mean tomorrow. Here, I'm using tomorrow to mean far from now, 40 years from now. That's the way you're going to use tomorrow to build this network. Yesterday, tomorrow, we do this all just yesterday. It was not possible to visit China. Maybe tomorrow, right? We use these time compressions all the time in language. If we make changes now, we can prevent a lot of pain later on. So here's one, big ideas in time and space that come about from conceptual integration that I heard on National Public Radio. The purpose of this is to get people to change their ideas about consuming fish. Right? Now, I don't see the fish out in the ocean. I don't see where the fish come from. I don't have any experience of those fish. But they want me to think about it. We are eating the food off our children's plates. When we overfish, we eat not only today's fish, but tomorrow's fish too. Now notice, by the way, you don't use tomorrow to mean the day after today. Automatically, in the integration network, use that projection to mean a much later time, because in the blend we're going to have a compression. Now what's going on here? Let's look at the language and the concepts that we construct in response to this language. Well, there's a long chain of stuff. Right now there's a certain amount of fishing, and that's causal over time, long time. So there's a cause-effect vital relation and a time vital relation. That's causal for the amount of fish I eat, or people eat, the consumption of fish. Notice fishing for fish and consumption of fish are two very different things. It's important to hold that in mind. They're very, very different, and they're far apart. And then, of course, there's a long-range dependency from both of these to the stock that's available later on out in the ocean, how many fish there are. There's a time relation and a cause. This is just like an inconvenient truth. Okay. And there's a difference in these enormous compressions just down to these lines, so you can compare them. And also, you can compare the two different scenes. In this one, there is a smaller amount of fishing. That's a compression. In that one, there's a larger amount of fishing. And you can see that if there's less fishing, there's less consumption, and so more stock. And over here, more fishing means more consumption and less stock. Okay? So let's compare the two green ones. This is the stock that would be available if we ate that much. Notice that's a hypothetical blend. I'm taking fishing and things like that, but I'm changing the amount we eat, and now getting you to run the blend, and you say, oh, if we only fished less, there'd be a lot more stock because you're running the blend and doing the inferences in the blend. So you can compare these two, and you can say, ah, in the one where we fish a lot, there's little stock. And the one where we fish less, there's more stock, right? Fish less, more stock, fish more, less stock, right? We can compare them. There's analogy and disanalogy, and we can compress them, just as we saw yesterday. You can compress them to a unique element in the blend. The unique element in the blend is the amount of fish. There's just one problem. Some of those fish are missing. They have a feature. So the amount of fish comes in from this big line. But there are some fish there that have an interesting feature. They're missing. They're missing fish. Think of what the word missing is used to mean. It means I want you to put together an integration network in which there's an element that has a certain feature, and that element is, and that feature is not wet or brown or wood. It's missing, right? Now you're built to understand that things have features, right? So you take this extremely long-range dependency of contrasting hypothetical situations, chunk it down into something that's at human scale. Now we've got an object or a class of stuff, and some of those things have a feature they're missing, right? Now it's very important to see that you don't conceptualize what's in your scene by recognizing everything that's not in it. I'll give you an example of this. So look around the room, right? You understand the room? I can say President Barack Obama is not in this room. Now you recognize the absence of Barack Obama. That notion is in the recognition. It's part of your understanding, but it wasn't there before. It's not the case that you already know or conceive of everything that's not here. There's an infinite list, right? When I say something is missing, it's in your conception. It just has a feature. It's missing, and now that is an important conception for how you operate. Similarly, for the consumption of fish, right? Come on. Yeah. Here's the amount of consumption of fish we're doing. Here's the amount of consumption of fish we could be doing. Again, blend upon blend upon blend upon blend, compressing the amount we eat to this little line, putting it in an arrow. Right? There's an analogy and disanalogy between these things. In comes the amount of consumption, and now that line is all the consumption we're doing. But there's a certain part of it that is a certain action. It's not just consumption, it's over consumption. Now there's an action that has a certain feature. It's over consumption. Where up there it was just consumption. Now the red part is over consumption. It's the part of consumption that we're doing that we wouldn't be doing over in this space. So the analogy and disanalogy between those two spaces comes down into this blend. We have the consumption, and some of it now is overconsumption. So think of these words. I use these words. I say missing, overconsumption. Think of all the missing fish, right? What do we use those words for? To prompt you to put together a big integration network that's got a human scale scene. Similarly, same story. Once you see the pattern, you see it all over. This is the amount of fishing that we should be doing. It's irrealis. It's not right. This is the amount of fishing that we are doing. Now we have a blend. We're fishing out there, but we're not just fishing. Some of it's fishing and some of it is overfishing. It has a particular feature, right? There it is. There's the overfishing. I've manufactured this feature in the blend and gotten you to conceive of it. So that's what I mean when I say words don't have meanings. Words are prompts to people, little tiny prompts. In no sense do they encode meaning. They prompt you to put together a meaning. I can use things like missing fish, overconsumption, overfishing, and this feels, it's just no problem for you because double scope blending is what you do all the time. You're a cognitively modern human being. You have advanced cognition. This is not cognitively costly. You're doing it all the time. 99.99% of the blending you do, you never even recognize. It happens in backstage cognition. Most of it does not have any access to behavior. Certainly, the great majority of it is never recognized in consciousness because it doesn't need to be. Consciousness is just a thin little reed. It gives you some little products, right, that pop up out of this construction of meaning. And so these things are easy. Notice this is the way we talk when we want to persuade somebody of something and we want to give it to them in easy fashion. Asking them to do elaborate double scope blending, blends upon blends upon blends upon blends, that's what's easy for us if you construct them right. It's not cognitively costly and you can't shut it down. But there's more. We are eating the food off our children's plates. When we overfish, we eat not only today's fish, but tomorrow's fish too. Look at the compressions. Maybe you begin to see them now. One of the things that's happening is that the fishing and the eating are compressed, right? When we overfish, we eat. The overfishing is eating in the blend. That causal connection has been compressed, so the cause and the effect are now one action. Overfishing and eating tomorrow's fish, right? Similarly, the harvesting of the fish and the eating of the fish are collapsed, and harvesting present fish and eating future fish are collapsed, condensed, compressed in the blend. In fact, we're bringing in fish that our children would eat in way in the future. They're not even here yet. They haven't been born, those fish, right? But now, our overfishing right now is eating fish 20 years from now, right? In the blend, it becomes one action. So the overfishing takes on the moral tone of eating this food off your kids' plates. The present-day children are collapsed with their adult versions, just as we saw in Joey, Katie, and Todd will be performing your bypass. Overfishing now is taking kids' food away from them when they're adults. There's more compression. You scale tomorrow's future, children's future when they're adults is now tomorrow, just as we saw, tomorrow's good job. You compress that right down to a local time frame. It's just like Joey, Katie, and Todd, as we saw a minute ago. Now, there's more. There's an indulgence frame. If you're eating more than you should, if you're eating food right now that you're saving up for tomorrow's meal, that's socially disapproved and it's indulgent. You shouldn't do that. That's naughty. And in particular, you shouldn't eat somebody else's food. But there's more. Taking food needed by your children off your child's plate and eating it yourself is just about as bad as it gets. So now in the blend, fishing now is the same as depriving our children by stealing the food off their plates and eating it ourselves. This is bad. And you're supposed to carry that little packet around with you, human scale, and hold on to it, and unpack it as you act in the world. So now your actions that have something to do with fishing and eating will be understood, or if this is successful, understood under the influence of this new packed little notion. By the way, I should say, in English, in America, you probably have to say, when we overfish, we are eating the food off our children's plates. It may be, I don't know, that in China, children eat a lot of fish. There are plenty of places I do know that children eat fish. But in the United States, it's not a favorite kid's food. You have to put it in batter and fry it up and they eat fish sticks or something like that. One of my children eats both mussels and salmon, and all of them like salmon now, so that's good. So notice the little compression here. It's not just fish that you're taking off the child's plate. It's all of their food, right? So now you're taking the food off your child's plate. Compression, big ideas. You can hold on to enormous ideas that are not at all at human scale because you can compress them by integration to a scene that is at human scale. And from that scale, you can understand the big network. It's like an inconvenient truth and global chain warming and educating children so that they will be able to do bypasses far from now, right? It's not that we just have infinite minds and are not restricted to the kind of scale that other species are. We are. It's that we can use conceptual integration in order to bring in ranges of stuff we're not built to understand to something we are built to understand so that we can continue to grasp it. We saw this kind of compression in the mirror network where the fastest milers from 6 decades were put on the track, and now they're all racing against each other right now. We're not deluded. We don't think that's true, but it's a packed conception we have that we can use to understand the increase in people's speed in the mile over 60 years, right? We saw this in the Grim Reaper. You feed the bears and gradually over time and generations, the bears come to be comfortable approaching humans, and ultimately because you left food in a garbage can or planted orchards so they could eat the fruit or left bird seed out, now the bears are coming into other people's backyards and the ranger has to come and shoot the bear. This gets compressed down to one scene where you feed the bear dies, right? Nobody's deluded. We saw that integration network. We saw these kinds of compressions also for the dinosaurs. The dinosaurs turn into birds. This is compressed into one scene. And now what we're understanding is change or analogy and disanalogy across millions of years. Millions of years. Same kinds of compressions. Now, let me indicate to you that this kind of compression is almost never seen, right? You almost never recognize it. So here's a quotation. If Vera Tobin, in her brilliant dissertation, cites this. She quotes Hugh Kinner, who is a literary critic, and he's talking about a poem by Marianne Moore. The poem is called Poetry, right? And she revised it many times. Notice I say she revised it. What's this it? What she did is she wrote some stuff on paper, and another time she wrote some more stuff on paper, and 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 we have all that paper. So what's this it? What is the poem? Right? Well, there are analogies across all these things she wrote, and there are disanalogies across all these things she wrote, and now they get compressed. The analogies become a unique element, the poem, and the disanalogies become change for that element, revision. And in fact, what Hugh Kinner says is, he refers to Marianne Moore's poem, Poetry, as the one scarred by all those revisions. So now there's a thing, and stuff gets done to it, and it scars it, right? Well, of course, there's no thing that she worked on and scarred it. They're just, she wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote. And sometimes she published this one, and sometimes she published that one. Over a lot of years, this gets compressed into, now there's a poem, and she scarred it, right? There's a unique element with change for that element. And this is just the natural way to think of it. You think of it that way in the blend. There is a compression. There's a poem, and she worked on the poem, right? This is what you're built to do. I'll skip over this one. Okay, now what I want to say is this kind of compression, this kind of construction of big ideas in an integration network is at the root of our conception of our existence. So what is an individual human being? We have a conception of ourselves as having a personal identity that runs over time. Despite the fact that the baby who came out of my mother is so different from me, Mark Turner, at age 55. Look at all those differences. Still, across all those events, there's an analogy. There I am. Culture tries to tell me there's an analogy. It gives me a proper name. It calls me Mark Turner. I get it when I'm born, and I have it still. And we compress the analogies into a unique identity, and we say, there's change for that identity. Well, Mark Turner changed. Mark Turner learned something. He got certification, right? Now, this seems, you know, I know what you're thinking. What can this guy possibly be saying? But think of this. There's no evidence that any member of any other species has any conception like that about their personal identity, an identity that runs over years, right? They just don't work that way. There's no, I mean, we can't talk to them. We can't ask them what they think. But there's no evidence at all that anything but human beings have anything like your sense of individuality. When I was a child, I spake as a child, I understood as a child, I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. These are the kinds of conceptions we have, right? They're highly creative. Not just personal identity, but a human scale sense of time. We can hold on to that personal identity, and this makes it possible for culture to have the idea of certification. So, for instance, I can teach now certain kinds of things because I got a PhD in 1983. Okay, that was 24 years ago, 26 years ago. What on earth does that have to do with the fact that, with me teaching now, right? Well, we're able to have this idea. There was a change for this individual. This individual now has a feature. This person is educated. This person is qualified. Various kinds of social ontologies for the personal identity become possible because of this big time compression that we can do through conceptual integration. Moreover, remembrance of things past. You remember things from the past, and I want to challenge you here, because when you remember something from the past, it seems as if it comes with its own emotion. So you remember something embarrassing from the past. You did something, it was embarrassing. Okay, right? This is a problem. You remember a moment from the past, you remember the embarrassment. Now look, just think about it. No theorist of cognition imagines that memories come with their own separate emotional system. That I have one right here in my brain right now that's running this scene. And when I have the memory brings in an entirely separate emotional system. No, what I have to do is activate certain things in my brain that have to do with reference to the past and use my present emotional and affective system, the one I've got right now, and blend it with that past stuff so that my current emotions, which I feel, can provide the blend with emotional content. I can, in fact, feel embarrassment right now, right here, in remembering something from the past. So this now makes it possible for you to have a conception of a past self by blending some things that you take as having reference in the past with your current human-scale emotional abilities. Even though I'm not at all embarrassed right here, right now, I can feel embarrassment right now in the blend for the thing that was in the past, right? But I can do it in a number of different ways. Suppose, for example, the thing that comes up, you remember you were embarrassed then, but you think, the only reason I was embarrassed was peer pressure, and now you feel proud about what you did in the past. So in the blend now, where you are thinking, where you have the past event, instead of having the embarrassment that you remember from the past event, now you have pride in the blend for what's going on. But then you can activate more and somebody can prompt you and you can blend in your current feelings of embarrassment and try to activate these things. What I'm saying is that we have a conception of self running over time that is only possible because we have this ability to do really creative blending of self and memory, to create in the blend a sense of a past self connected to ourself. This is a big deal. So look at human memory. I'm going to say something now that's going to be pretty pushy. We invent time machines, like the TARDIS and so on, in imagination. And one of the original time machines, H.G. Wells, was what? Well, it was a handle. And if he pushed it this way, he went into the past. But notice, he had to go through time into the past successively. So he has to go through the day, and then the night, and then the day, and then the night. If he pushes the handle over hard, the days and the nights change really fast, right? And he can also do it for the future. Okay, that's of course a blend of motion and so on, moving through space with memory. It's a very, very standard one. Time is space. We'll talk about that this afternoon when we talk about metaphor. But notice human memory doesn't work like that. In human memory, you don't have to go, you don't have to rewind the tape in order to remember yesterday. What did you do yesterday midday morning? Boom, there it is. You just drop in. Right? Now, this is really amazing. Why should we have minds that do what George Eliot writes here? Our moods are apt to bring with them images which succeed each other like the magic lantern pictures of a doze. And in certain states of dull forlornness, Dorothea all her life continued to see the vastness of St. Peter's, the huge bronze canopy, the excited intention in the attitudes and garments of the prophets. So as she goes through her life, she keeps dropping in on things from this particular moment in the past. Well, why does memory work like this? Hypothesis I put forward with Gilles Foucault is it works like this because it really fuels blending. If the only things you have to blend are what are in your current experience, you're really very limited. But if now memory can work so as to activate things that are very far out of your current experience, suddenly now you have the ability to put, you have more grist for your blending mill. You have a lot more input spaces that you can use in constructing blends to think about the present, to think about other kinds of things. Memory has this, it's very useful, I will say, that memory, that human memory has this goofy feature that you can just drop on anything, because it provides wonderful material for blending. And this is just the standard way we think of it. Macintosh, Apple systems now provide a thing called Time Machine. It does incremental backups of everything on your hard disk. And the way it does it is one sort of thing, but that's not at all how they want you to think of it, because they want you to have a blend that is at human scale. So when you enter the Time Machine, it shows you the window of your files right now, and then it shows you for all these different times back on the timeline, it shows you what you had before, and you can just go back. See, they stretch back all the way to the beginning of time there, or the beginning of your hard disk, and you can just go back and drop in and activate it. Now, this is not the way the hardware is working and the software is working at all, but this is the way they want you to think of it, right? You can just drop in on the past and activate it and pull it into the present. Now, it's also the case with future selves, right? Future selves are not even here. How can you have a conception of a future self? How can you think about what it's going to be like when you're 80, right? Well, you have frames for those kinds of age experiences, and you can integrate it with your current emotional, affective, reasoning abilities. And in the blend now, you have a future self. Having a daydream, right? You have an extended self, a big idea, and it actually has effect on the present. You can do the opposite sort of thing. If, for example, you have a future scene that would create tension, you try to block it out so that it doesn't come in. You're not always successful because you don't want to feel anxious right now, right? So you often manage the local scene not by responding to it, but by blending in something different that would have a different effect on your psychology, your mental acuity, your desire, so that you can use that in the scene that you're in. You manage yourself. Many ways in which we manage the self. Okay, this is also how we can have conceptions of other minds. Because I just see your appearance, I see your behavior, that's it. But I know about my mental states, and I can blend them with, there's an analogy and a disanalogy between you and me, but I can make a blend, and now in the blend you have a mind like mine. And there can be emergent structure from your behavior. I can construct slight differences for your mind from mine. Again, this seems like nothing, but there's no evidence that any other species can do this at all at our sort of level. What I want to say is, and I think this will be the last bit, so we can have some questions. There's another brilliant researcher, Michael Tomasello, who talks about theory of mind, about being able to conceive of other people and how they operate. And there are evolutionary psychologists who talk about this amazing ability. At least it is recognized in science that explaining this ability to imagine that there's another mind like ours is a huge scientific problem that needs an answer. Now, there are different possibilities that have been put forward. One is that you just have Swiss Army knife brains. You have different capacities, and a special module evolved that made it possible for you to have social cognition. And on this view, there's just a separate module for doing that, and it has no particular computational relationship to any other. There's another possibility. This is the one that I've been putting forward here, and that is that human beings have the capacity for double scope blending. And we have it generally, and that's what we use in order to construct concepts of other minds. And in fact, what I'd like to say is that we use it not just for other people. We use it for animals, we use it for ships, for buildings, for cartoon characters. You can actually attribute intentionality to a house. We do it all the time. This is not nearly as restricted as theory of mind would have us believe. Another is that early on in life, you used your double scope blending ability to come up with a template of what another mind is, but you don't have to rebuild it from scratch every time. You've got it in just the way you've got the cause motion construction, in just the way you've got conceptions of time and space and so on. You get them, and you don't have to remanufacture them from scratch every time. You can activate them. And another one is that because you could do this, genetic assimilation picked up that capacity a little and gave you a kind of head start. Now, Michael Tomasello, who's a brilliant researcher, writes in The Cultural Origins of Human Cognition that this ability to have social cognition is really the thing that distinguishes us. It's what makes it possible to have culture. And so he goes through an argument. And what I would say is my argument is just like his argument, except that where he says the evolution of social cognition, I say the evolution of double scope blending. And social cognition is a consequence. It's a subcase of double scope blending. So he's right about this. It's just, it's not the only thing we do. On the contrary, it's a very important one. But double scope blending is used across a great range. We use it all over the place. So blending is adaptive in my theory, in just the way it is in Tomasello's theory. It makes it possible for us to have culture. It makes it possible for us to have the ratchet effect, where we can have the whole culture support the same idea and keep it going, things like that. It's just that he says, my particular claim is that in the cognitive realm, and I've talked to Mike about this a lot, and he's not unhappy with my story. He says, as long as you've got the social part in there, then you have what I need for an evolutionary story, so I'm happy enough, right? My particular claim is that in the cognitive realm, the biological inheritance of humans is very much like that of other primates. He's right about that, but I think that's a misleading statement, right? Because what he's going to say is there's just one major difference, and that is the fact that human beings identify with conspecifics, that's other members of your species, more deeply than do other primates. That's certainly something we do, but it's not the only thing we do. And it's just one example of double scope blending. It's one subcase. That ability for social cognition is quite inadequate to account for the details of invention of complex numbers, hyperbolic geometry, money, grammatical constructions, counterfactual thought, and so on. Human beings do an awful lot of things. They're very creative in integrating things, not just in conceiving of other minds. One of the things they use blending for is to conceive of other minds. So Tomasello's got it right. It's just that I move it one step back. Social cognition is really crucial, but it's not the root difference. The root difference is double scope blending, which makes it possible to have higher order social cognition. Okay. We project intentionality to rattlesnakes. I know that a rattlesnake is not evil and doesn't really want to be mean to me, but I'm from Southern California, and I once woke up and there was a rattlesnake, and I was freaked out, and I wanted to kill the thing. I wanted to kill the thing not just to preserve myself. I wanted to kill the thing because it was mean and evil and trying to scare me. Now, of course, I know the rattlesnake doesn't do that at all. But in the blend, I attributed that kind of intentionality to the rattlesnake, and it really motivates. We can do this to an old piece of a shirt we have. We wear a shirt, it's old, we wear it out, we throw it away. But, you know, we feel a little bad for the shirt. Does it feel bad being thrown away? I have a little robot in my house that sweeps the floor. It's called Roomba, right? And Roomba goes around at 3 o'clock in the morning every night and sweeps the floor, vacuums the floor. And my children love Roomba. They talk to it. They give it names. They know it's a robot. They give it names. They talk to it. They say, come on, Roomba. They talk about feeding Roomba when they take dirt and put it in Roomba's way, right? Now, Roomba stopped working. So I shook Roomba and whacked it around a little, and they said, you're being mean to Roomba, right? Now, of course, they know that Roomba's just a machine. But this kind of projection of mind, this blending, is something we do all the time. We do it with non-animate objects. We do it with each other. And in fact, what I'm going to do is end with a long list of extraordinary things that human beings can do as a result of having conceptual integration. I just won't go through them. We're able to have a highly developed and advanced sense of personal identity. We are able to think with feeling about events that are not here in our present scale. We are able to have a sense of the past and the future and ourselves in them, of other minds. We are able to manage our future selves. So think of people, for instance, who have credit cards and they cut them up because they don't want their future self to get weak and use them. We often do things now because we think that future self will be different, that future self will be excited or undisciplined or drunk or something like that, and we better do something now to control that future self, right? We're able to do this kind of self-management. We're able to think of counterfactual scenes, like what it would be like if we were not fishing this much. We're able to put together forms and meanings into little tools that other people can then take as prompts to construct these kinds of mental events. We're able to have political ontology and its laws, social memory, concepts like punishment, redemption, guilt, sin, and money, which are things that run over long stretches of time and take things that are very separated in time and space and compress them into blend. Just one example. Somebody does something back there 20 years ago. Now we do something bad to that person right now. Right? And we don't say, oh, well, that's one bad thing back then and another bad thing right now. We say, no, this isn't just a bad thing. This is punishment. Now in the blend, there's an action and it's punishment. Or somebody does something bad in the past, they failed. But now they do something good here that's like the past thing. It's not just, well, okay, there's one bad one and one good one. No, now this is redemption. This overcomes the failure that attached to one's personal identity from the last one. There's up millions of stories in the world and movies and legends about redemption. Concepts like redemption are extremely, extremely creative. They're only possible because we are able to have to hold on to these long-range conceptions by having these kinds of compressions. Now, this afternoon, I am going to talk very specifically about a particular metaphor that we have that goes over time and space, and go through, it's a metaphor, and go through what's really happening in that metaphor to show the kinds of compressions and also to give an idea of what I think is an advance in metaphor analysis, an advance in metaphor theory and how it ought to work. So as I said, today is going to be a bookends. You had Dirk's analysis this morning, brilliant analysis of the role of historical, diachronic linguistics and social change in metaphor and how this needs to be incorporated into metaphor analysis. And this afternoon, I'm going to give an analysis of mental operations and how we need to reconceive human mental operations in order to do metaphor analysis. And the metaphor I'm picking is time is space, because that is a metaphor that gives us a very big idea. Thank you very much.